This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll talk about a major victory that the Center for Constitutional Rights just had in court on behalf of the Telephone Justice Campaign.
Telephone calls at $4 a minute? That's what New York State prisons had until a few days ago. And that practice still goes all over the United States. Some 40 states charge exorbitant rates. The Center for Constitutional Rights won it in New York. Let's hope other states do the same.
Renditions. You've heard us talk about it for years. Today, we'll have an interview concerning Italian proceedings in an abduction.
Think about this one. Isn't this great news? The Italians have indicted over 20 CIA agents for abducting an Egyptian cleric off their streets and sending him to Egypt, where he was tortured. Welcome to Law and Disorder. This is Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I'm Michael Smith, New York City attorney and author.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
I'm Dahlia Hashad, director of the USA program at Amnesty International.
Here on Law and Disorder, we four lawyers and activists will strive to be your eyes and ears, your early warning system, your educators, counselors, and advocates. Here, we'll talk about the laws, practices, and procedures that we believe are strangling democracy. We'll be in the courts, in the books, on the streets, and here on the radio with you. We hope that we'll be lawyers you will like.
The great civil liberties attorney Bill Kunstler saw it coming. The police state is emerging, he warned. It's coming piece by piece, before and especially after September 11th.
Recent update on the taser issue that we've been following. As you'll remember, tasers are handheld electronic devices that can shoot bolts of electricity through the human body. Police officers all around the country have this weapon and say that they use this weapon to disable somebody so that they can get control of this person. Amnesty International has been tracking taser use since July of 2001, and since then we've recorded that over 220 people have died after being shot with a taser. The primary manufacturer of these weapons is Taser International, and they have just recently, this month, launched their newest model of their civilian version of a taser, meaning anyone out there can go out and get this taser, so long as they pass some very basic security checks. It can be brought to you in pink, electric blue, titanium silver, or maybe the manly black. You can pick up this weapon, toss it into your purse with your cell phone and your keys, and pull it out and shock the person nearest you. The problem with this is that the taser is an untested weapon. It has not been appropriately tested in independent, comprehensive medical research. So we don't really know what the taser does when it hits people. And we've seen that recently. Within the same week that Taser launched this product, we had a couple of people die after being shot with a taser, one in New York State. You know, another, we had a pregnant woman in the Midwest, I believe it was Missouri. She miscarried after being shot with the taser. And we hear these stories, unfortunately, every single week. There's always continuing problems with the taser. Now, where the civilian taser is concerned, there is gross margin for misuse. Since we've been tracking this issue, we've been looking largely at police use of the taser. Now, with police, even though they are not tightly regulated or regulated at all in many cases, at least police officers have to show up every day at work, and they're supposed to account for how they use this weapon, or they should account for how they use this weapon and why it's used and receive some sort of training. Now, all of that is horribly inadequate. However, when you put this weapon in the hands of civilians who don't have to come into work every day and don't have to account for how they're using it, they're receiving no training, they're receiving no understanding of how this weapon works, you end up with instances like we saw in San Antonio, where a man who was taking his trash out was shot with a taser And then he was reportedly had to have open heart surgery. This was in October. In another instance, a man took his estranged wife, kidnapped her, and tied her up in a hotel room. While she was bound, he used an electric, one of those tasers, to abuse her and torture her. Another instance where a bouncer was armed with a taser as part of his job and is charged with assault for using the taser inappropriately on individuals.
There was a big victory in New York State, a victory that may spread across to the 30 or 40 other states that also charge exorbitant rates for prisoners to call their families, making it almost impossible for prisoners to be in touch with their loved ones. The big victory happened on January 7th. It was a victory really for both the families and for the inmates in New York State penal institutions across the state. Prior to this time, New York State had let out an exclusive contract with only one telephone company. That telephone company, in this case Verizon, was permitted to charge exorbitant rates, up to $4 a minute for the first minute, excessive rates after that. It would result in hundreds of dollars of phone bills a month. Remember that New York State prisons are located far from urban centers, where most of the prison population comes from. It made it impossible for inmates to communicate with their family. They had to go into deep debt to do so. The Center for Constitutional Rights, where I work, has been working on this issue for 4 or 5 years. We've had a strong grassroots campaign made up of both the families and former inmates who were involved in challenging this. We've had court cases. It's been a broad, big, major effort, legislative in the governor's office, as well as in the courts. Finally, on January 7th, the new Governor Spitzer decided New York was no longer going to have this confiscatory policy. He said the contract will not be renewed in April of this year. One other thing I want to say about the contract, that not only gave exorbitant fees and profits to the telephone company, it also contained a kickback to the state of approximately 50% of the money earned. So you essentially had the prisoners paying for their own incarceration. Spitzer, to his credit on this one, said that he would replace that money so that the state could continue to have programs for AIDS and others for prisoners that did not come out of the back pockets of some of the poorest people in the state. It's a major victory, and today we're going to have on our show Annette Dickerson, who is the Education and Outreach Director at the Center for Constitutional Rights, who has led this fight for 4 years in all of its phases. So we're going to be pleased to have Annette on the show. We'll also have Rachel Mirapol, an attorney at the center, who actually the day after Spitzer's decision argued in the New York State Court of Appeals, the state's highest court, that the process, the program, the contract was illegal and unconstitutional. The contract doesn't end till April, so the case is still out there and pending, and the case also sought damages. But this was a major, major people's victory for not just the people in prison, but really for anybody who cares about equality, fairness, and the whole principle that families should be united and not split apart. Annette, welcome to Law and Disorder. Okay. Why don't you tell us a little bit about, first, when we say prison telephone, what does that really mean? What is that?
These phone contracts, these exclusive provider phone contracts that exist between state departments of correctional services and these phone companies that, as a part of the terms of getting the contract, are required, contractually required, to deliver a kickback back to the state. The percentage, in New York's case, that percentage was 57.5%, but that varies. This occurs in 40 other states, by the way.
So there's 40 other states that actually have this sort of kickback system.
That's correct.
How much money did the state of New York get in kickbacks over the 10 years of this contract?
Well, family members have paid over $200 million.
Whoa.
And that doesn't count, you know, what the phone company has made. The phone company has made over $400 million.
And this is an exclusive contract, no other bidders, nothing, right?
No other bidders, no other choice of calling systems.
How many people are incarcerated in New York State?
About 65,000, which is a conservative estimate. You know, that's 130,000 people affected right there. You're not even talking about the number of kids that were, you know, adversely affected by these impediments to communication.
Can you tell us something about the effects on people that, this had?
As a public policy issue, it affects the incarcerated person's ability to successfully and effectively reenter society upon release. Numerous studies have been done that prove that maintaining strong ties with your family and with your community makes it easier for you to have something to come back to. You've already got your support system in place. These phone rates seriously impede successful reentry. Secondly, the effect on the families is just enormous. We have been told, it's not an aberration to say that family members routinely make critical decisions between paying other bills like rent and food and gas and light in order to pay these exorbitant phone rates. And so, as you know, the facilities are being constructed further and further and further away from the home communities of the people who are incarcerated. Transportation is, very, very difficult. The trip is long and arduous. Very often, the phone is the only way that people can stay in contact.
How much would a 15-minute phone conversation cost?
A 19-minute phone conversation would cost $6. Plus a $3 connect fee.
Yeah, that's ridiculous.
So
you could
$9.
Talk to Europe for 3 cents a minute.
So it's $9.
Absolutely.
Let me ask you, Annette, as you began this campaign, Annette, what did you do? How did you go about trying to win this?
Well, there were a number of fronts. First of all, what we needed to do was to make it safe and make it a positive experience for family members to come out from behind this wall of shame. You know, the subtext of this whole policy and the fact that it's been able to prosper and thrive, the subtext is that there is shared guilt, that this is a population of people that simply because, they are related or they love someone who's incarcerated, that there is a shared guilt and there's a shared punishment. So therefore, they deserve to be treated in a certain way. So we had to make sure that, at every turn, at every juncture, that those kinds of misconceptions were dispelled. And so we constantly used, our internal press apparatus as well as the consultants that we were fortunate enough to be able to engage to do media trainings to enable people to, without shame and without fear, and frankly with a little bit of savvy, to be able to speak to the press, because they had to be front and center of this campaign. I could talk until the cows come home, but the most eloquent spokespeople are those people who are paying the bills. So that was number one, training and preparing and developing a cadre of prison family members, including children, offspring, who were able to speak to this issue. The second piece was really organizing and getting broad-based support for this. Some people can be very anti-inmate, but this is a family issue. This is a public safety issue. This is a consumer fairness issue. This is a constitutional right issue. This is a tax issue. This is an issue about the authority of a state agency to impose this kind of levy on people with no legislative, intervention whatsoever. So, crafting a message that encapsulated all of these things was really, really critical.
Tell us about the victory and the reaction to it.
Well, the reaction to the victory from...
Well, tell us about the victory and what the exact substance of your victory.
The substance of the victory is huge. In effect, what the governor has done is he has eliminated the commission, i.e. the kickback to the state, which eliminates, the whole incentive for having these contracts. First of all, a collect call system is the most expensive system that you can operate, by far. But what it effectively does is it ends the contract in its current incarnation. The effective date of this is April the 1st, which coincides with the end of the current contract, which means that a new contract, a new RFP has to be issued, new negotiations have to be done, And it's conceivable, you know, that it, in an open bidding process, that another company may, you know, get the business. So,
who has the business now, Annette?
Verizon has the business, which they inherited from MCI when they took over the company in March of 2006.
They won't be contributing any money to Spitzer's next campaign.
They won't, but you must know that there's a company called Global Tellink who is going around the country. They specialize in the delivery of phone systems to state prisons. They're going around and buying up these contracts. Verizon is in the process of selling off their business to this company. Call it like a Pontius Pilate move, you know, so they can say their hands are clean, but they're still dirty.
It seems to me that the Verizon had the same relationship to the government of New York that Halliburton has to the American government getting contracts in Iraq. But the question I had for you is the federal prison system has a different way of setting up phone calls, which is much cheaper.
It's an 800 system, yes, and it's 7 cents a minute.
So why doesn't New York do that?
Well, because of the financial incentive. You know, at the outset of this campaign, there were more prisoners. The annual take was $26 million. That's a heck of a lot of money to give up. And they went to pay for things that the state should have paid for. Now, at the beginning, before this campaign started, the most shameful thing about the use of the money was that over two-thirds of it was going to pay for HIV and AIDS medications for prisoners, which is an outrage. And in effect, it meant that family members were paying for the health care of their incarcerated loved ones. Once the campaign began and we began to illuminate that egregious part of the arrangement, you know, they miraculously found some money, you know, some general fund money to pay for that. And so in past years, the recorded money that has been spent, that's been taken in, fluctuated anywhere from $17 to $15 million. But still, it was enough money to make the state senate in particular very reluctant to pass legislation barring the practice. Because then they'd have to find the money in the general budget, which fortunately the governor has courageously, you know, decided to do.
Annette, I would imagine that you would have a strong constituent in attorneys who receive collect calls from inmates since
yes.
They're over 60,000. Did they participate in the campaign?
Most definitely. Actually, the New York State Defenders Association, led by Jonathan Gradess up in Albany, is a plaintiff in the Walton case, which, as you know, was argued in the Court of Appeals yesterday. The Neighborhood Defender Service, Bronx Defenders, the Office of the Appellate Defender, the Legal Aid Prisoners Rights Project, they have very, very much come forward and been active participants in this as well, because it impedes their ability to effectively serve their clients.
Annette, we understand from a speech that Eric Schlosser, who's just written a book on the prison industrial complex here in the country, gave that we broadcast on our show a couple weeks ago, that there are some over 2 million prisoners across the country, that the average income of these people before they were imprisoned is only $10,000. These are poor people. Three-quarters of them are people of color.
Yeah.
Are you going to be able to take this tremendous victory here in New York State and get it spread across the country?
Absolutely. People are really, really starting to organize around this issue. Virginia has made some headway legislatively. Unfortunately, the budget was not allocated in order to execute the change. So Nebraska has eliminated the commissions. Washington State is the most recent state before New York to end the commissions. California has a burgeoning organizing effort. Our goal, and part of our mandate actually, was to make this a replicable model that other states could emulate.
We're going to go next to talk to Rachel Mirapol about the argument, but just give us your impressions of what happened in the Court of Appeals when Rachel Mirapol was arguing the Walton case on prison telephone.
Very interestingly, the justices were hard on particularly the docs attorney. The crux of this particular matter is the statute of limitations issue. And our argument
corrections.
Is that, you know, the harm continues every time somebody, you know, enters the system and their people start having to receive these bills. You know, Docs was arguing that, you know, we should have treated it as an Article 78 proceeding. It was funny because Ivy Walton, the named plaintiff, was there. And the justices kept saying, well, what is Mrs. Walton to do? You know, what is Mrs. Walton to do? You know, are you telling me that just because somebody missed a filing deadline, that their constitutional rights, you know, are suddenly eradicated? You know, you've got to come up with something better than that. But the light moment was when the MCI attorney got up there and literally said that they were an innocent victim of all of this. I mean, people in the courtroom even had to laugh. They had to break with decorum, you know.
That's great.
And laugh at that. Because his point, which is well taken, is that as of April 1st, they got to reduce their rates by 57.5%. And they are a business, after all. So, yeah. You know, this will have an effect on them, but didn't garner much sympathy at all.
Annette, what you mentioned the word DOCS. What is DOCS?
I'm sorry. That's the New York State Department of Correctional Services.
Okay, my last question is, when you heard that Spitzer was changing the law on Monday, what was your reaction?
My initial reaction was I was stunned. I mean, I was physically stunned. You know, Michael, you know that we have been working all kinds of avenues and legislatively, you know, organizing, using personal contacts. So I was fairly confident that he was going to do something. I know that there were people who actively support the campaign, who were members of his inside team, who were advising him accordingly. But I really did not expect this to occur with such expedience. I really didn't. And so it really stunned me.
Well, it's a heroic victory by all the people you worked with,
yeah.
And particularly by you as the leader of the campaign, Annette. So it's really a very proud moment for you and everybody out there who were engaged in this struggle. So
well,
thank you for
excited.
All of us.
And congratulations.
Thank you for your support as well.
Ah, incredible, Annette. Okay.
Bye, Annette.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Bye, Annette.
Bye.
Rachel, welcome to Law and Disorder. Congratulations on the great victory in Prison Telephone.
Oh, thank you, and thank you for having me on the show.
We know you argued last week in the Court of Appeals, and we wanted you to give us a sense of what happened in the argument, and of course, begin with why it was relevant after you already had won, essentially, Prison Telephone, at least in some view you'd won.
Well, sure. Actually, that was the first question I got asked by Judge Kay. Basically, What Spitzer announced earlier in the week was that at the end of the current contract term, they're going to change the prison telephone system so that the state will no longer demand commissions from the family members of prisoners, from all individuals who accept prisoner collect calls. However, that contract doesn't end until April of 2007. So right now, we're still under the old administration system. And under that system, we are arguing, and we argue to the court, that our clients are forced to pay an unlawful tax each time they accept the collect call from a prisoner. So, you know, it's really important that the court rule on this issue, even though Spitzer has announced that the state will change its policy, because it's important for my clients to get a declaration as to what their rights are. They've been seeking court intervention on this issue for years now, and no court in New York State has yet ruled on the merits of our claims. It's also most important so that this doesn't happen again. You know, we don't want any future administration to come in and decide that, you know, the prison telephone system, the way it worked before Spitzer came to office, is a good thing to go back to. So we need this court to rule that the system was unconstitutional.
Now, Rachel, that'll also help. I know, I think it's in 40 other states or so. If you can get a ruling here, I think that might have a good effect. I mean, is that right?
Absolutely. And I think, you know, I think Spitzer's action is so important in setting an example for the rest of the country. And a ruling from the court would be incredibly important on that avenue as well.
That's wonderful. Now, tell us a little about how the argument went. I know you're representing some of the people who actually were subjected to this policy.
Yes. Yes. I think the argument went well. The judges seemed very interested in the case. They asked a lot of questions of me and of the attorney who is there representing the Department of Correctional Services. And their questioning showed that they were considering this as an issue that affects real people. They asked specifically, you know, how can an individual who's accepting collect calls from prison, how can that individual get relief? You know, how are they supposed to know the system as it's stopped, until they start collecting, until they start receiving bills for their collect calls. And, of course, that's what we've been arguing, that because people accept collect calls each month and are billed each month, that it's an appropriate time to bring this action.
Now, what happens after April 1st?
Well, we don't know yet exactly. I mean, what we've heard from Spitzer is that the new contract is not going to include a commission term. Now, we don't know anything yet about what the contract will look like, whether docs will receive any money from the contract, whether MCI will still be, or Verizon now, will still be the sole provider. You know, I think it's an issue that it's really important for us to follow up afterwards and make sure that whatever system is put in place is a system that is going to operate to give families and prisoners the most opportunity to communicate with each other. That's what we really see here.
Now, how many years has this case been litigated for?
Well, Walton has been litigating. Walton, which is the case that was in court earlier this week, has been just 3 years now. But we've been in court. Center for Constitutional Rights has been in court on the issue since 1999. So it's been really a long struggle.
Well, congratulations, Rachel. I heard you did a great job in the argument. It's your first argument in New York's highest court. Is that right?
Yes, first time in the Court of Appeals. That's right.
Very ornate courtroom, as I recall.
It's quite nice in there.
Well, the judges like it nice. Anyway, congratulations, Rachel. It's a great victory, really, for the people of New York State and, of course, the prisoners and their families.
Well, thank you, and thanks for having me on.
Great job,
thank you, Rachel.
Rachel. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Hello, everybody. I want to tell you about a little dream I had this morning. I had a dream that I went down this beautiful corridor, and there was a cot. And there was someone sleeping in the cot. And I went, and there sleeping under a beautiful piece of white muslin was Gandhi. And I stood over him and watched him sleep. And next to him there was a water glass, and it was empty. So I put some distilled water in it and watched him sleep for a while. And then I woke up. And what I took that as, I took it as a good sign. I took it to remember one important thing, the most important thing, that the people can accomplish anything, but how do the people accomplish it? Through their numbers. These little gatherings are the beginning. We must unite, and we must get strong, we must be clean, and if you're worried about all of the things that they're trying to make you scared about, whether it's germs or anything, you want to do something for yourself, take care of yourself, build your immune system, be strong, don't be afraid, and don't be led by the media. I was dreaming, in my dreaming, well of an aspect bright and fair. And my sleeping, it was broken, but my dream, it lingered near. In the farm of shining valleys, where the pure air recognized. And my senses newly open, 'cause I awaken into the cry that the people have the power to redeem the world from fools. Upon the meek, the grace is shower. It's decreed that people rule. People have the power. People have the power. People have the power. People have the power. Vengeful aspects became suspect and bending low as if to hear. And the armies ceased advancing because the people had their ear. And the shepherds and the soldiers, where they laid beneath the stars, exchanging visions, laying arms to waste in the dust, in the form of shining valleys where the pure air recognized and my senses newly opened, cause I awaken to the cry, come on.
Hold on.
People have the power. People have the power. People have the power. People have the power. Where there were deserts, I saw fountains, and like cream, the waters rise, and we strolled there together, when under laugh or criticize, and the leopard and the lamb lay together, truly bound. Well, I was hoping, in my hoping, to recall what I had found. I was dreaming, in my dreaming, God knows a pure view. As I surrender into my sleeping, I commit my dream to you. Come on. People have the power. People have the power. People have the power. People have the power. The power to dream, to rule, to wrestle the world from fools. It's decreed. The people rule. It's decreed the people rule. Listen, I believe everything we dream can come to pass through our union. We can turn the world around. We can turn the Earth's revolution. We have the power. People have the power. The people have the power. The people have the power. Don't forget it. You have the power. Use your voice.
Today we're going to talk about another one of those infamous renditions, sending people from one country by the United States to a place where they will be tortured. Today's story concerns an Egyptian cleric kidnapped off the streets of Italy by our own CIA. Well, this story doesn't have an ending yet. The Egyptian cleric is still in Egypt, presumably being tortured, and in Italy, the story has sent shockwaves through the government. A courageous Italian judge has indicted over 20 CIA agents for the kidnapping and the rendering of the Egyptian cleric to Egypt. Hear about that story today here on Law and Disorder, from Jumana Musa of Amnesty International.
Welcome, Jumana, to Law and Disorder.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Jumana, tell us about the recent case of Imam, who was swept off the streets of Milan, kidnapped and tortured by the U.S. government.
This is a case of rendition that was really striking in that it wasn't a case of, you know, a hapless, innocent person who may have gotten caught up in a system, but a case of somebody who was living as a resident in Italy, which is an allied nation, who had been under investigation for some time by Italian authorities and was soon to be indicted. And actually, they were hoping to use that indictment to indict others. The United States literally pulled up a white van in the middle of broad daylight on a street, kidnapped him into the van, you know, men with hoods. It's the kind of stuff the movies are made of. Men with hoods snatched him off the street, bundled him into this van, took him to the Aviano Air Base, and then shipped him off to Egypt, where he was, reports, being tortured severely in custody, thereby cutting short an Italian investigation and completely illegally rendering him into the custody of a country known for torturing people in custody.
So what happened to him in Egypt?
Well, I mean, he reports all the types of torture that you hear in Egypt. You know, there's some sophisticated methods and there's some not so sophisticated. You know, sometimes it's electroshocks and sometimes it's just straight-up beatings. He's still in custody and nobody in a prison, and nobody knows quite how this is going to resolve itself.
Talk to us about the types of torture.
Well, the types of torture we've seen in Egyptian custody, like I said, they run the gamut from just traditional beatings to extreme sleep deprivation, use of electroshock weapons, whether it's, as you know, was described in the case of Mamdouh Habib, being suspended and then put on a concrete roll where if you put your feet on it, you're immediately shocked, threats of rape by dogs, threats of killing family members, And so it's really both the some of the more sophisticated and some of the least sophisticated but most severe methods of torture that are in place in Egypt. And it goes by literally unchecked. Many times people who are tortured in custody are then brought before a military tribunal that finds them guilty with very little access to any evidence against them, without a defense, and, you know, without any even semblance of a fair trial. So the Egyptian system in terms of, you know, interrogation, torture, and convictions functions very smoothly, but it by no means provides anybody any kind of fair process, any protection against torture, or any mechanism to then get redress for having been tortured.
Now, apart from the kidnapping aspects of this, there's a law that says it's illegal to send people to a country that's more where they're more likely to be tortured than not. Isn't that the case?
Absolutely. Article 3 of the Convention Against Torture prohibits the return of any person to a country where there is a substantial risk of torture. The United States has justified getting around this by saying a couple things. Sometimes they say things that, well, we were just returning someone to their home country who requested them. The fact is the Convention Against Torture prohibits the return of somebody to their home country if there is a substantial risk of torture. Even if that person is wanted for a criminal offense, they still cannot be returned to torture. The other kind of, by the way, definition the United States has put out there is that while Article 3 of the Convention Against Torture doesn't apply outside of U.S. borders, although they say they apply it as a matter of policy outside of U.S. borders, I think for those of us who remember the United States saying that, in fact, the Geneva Conventions didn't apply to detainees in custody, but that they would treat them humanely as a matter of policy, and we know what happened to those folks. I think that as a matter of policy should not provide comfort for anybody. And the last thing the United States has done to circumvent this prohibition is to say, to seek these what they call diplomatic assurances, which is essentially a governmental promise that they won't torture somebody. And so we're meant to believe that if they go to a country like Egypt, who the U.S. government documents every single year as a country that tortures people in custody, and say, well, we're going to transfer this gentleman to you, and will you promise you won't torture this gentleman? And they say, yes, we promise, that that is somehow sufficient to return them, which is simply not the case. I think there's another case from Sweden where two men who were seeking asylum in Sweden from Egypt for fear of torture were then taken by the U.S. from Sweden back to Egypt. There was, in fact, monitoring in place that the Swedish government put in place, and they found those people had been tortured horribly. So even with assurances and with monitoring, there was still torture that occurred. So these assurances are completely disingenuous and don't in any way get to the issue of preventing torture.
How do we know that it was the U.S. government that kidnapped him? And if so, if we do, in fact, know it was the U.S. government, why? What would be their motives if he was already under investigation?
Well, there is an Italian prosecutor, Armando Spataro, who's been looking into this case from the beginning. And not only has he found evidence of U.S. government involvement, he has indicted a number of CIA agents. And this is a case that they're now trying to push to trial, as well as Italian intelligence officials. So this is not, you know, hearsay. This is due to a very thorough, long-term and complete investigation by an Italian prosecutor, you know, with eyewitness accounts and everything else.
So they've indicted, how many agents have they indicted, CIA agents?
I believe it's 22.
And the trial has actually begun, hasn't it?
Well, they're beginning sort of pre-trial and determining whether or not they'll be able to bring people here, whether or not they'll be able to go forward with this case, yes.
Have they asked for the extradition of the agents yet?
That's not happened formally, and there's a question as to whether or not the Italian government will ask formally for the extradition of the CIA agents. I think it's widely recognized that the U.S. is not going to turn these men over, but there's not yet been a formal request from the Italian government.
There's been some reverberations in Italy, and maybe you can recall them. The Italian head of intelligence was forced to resign or something. Maybe you can, are you familiar with that?
Absolutely, because I know sometimes we've, you know, seen some foreign governments try to take a, you know, don't ask, don't tell kind of approach to it, saying, oh, you know, we didn't know, we weren't aware. But I think many people find it, you know, again, a little bit disingenuous to assume that the United States is operating, you know, within a country without any kind of connection with the intelligence services. Now, again, that doesn't mean there was wide knowledge across the government, but in this case, there was clear indication that there was some Italian intelligence folks involved as well.
And I think the head of intelligence resigned as a result.
Yeah, by extension, I would suspect that the United States also has close relations with the Egyptian intelligence services. After all, I think next to Israel, the United States gives Egypt the second most money of any foreign country in the world.
Absolutely. Egypt is the second largest recipient of U.S. foreign aid. They've worked closely with the Egyptians for a long time, and I think one of the most worrying things, you know, from a human rights perspective, is that rather than using that aid to push Egypt on their human rights record, the U.S. now seems to be instead feeding into Egyptian human rights abuses by sending people
creating
there.
Human rights abuses. The U.S. government is consulting with the Egyptian government on the creation of their own quote-unquote anti-terror law that, you know, to get it to look a lot like what we have here.
You know, we at the Center for Constitutional Rights, as you know, represent Mahar Arar, who was the Canadian sent to Syria under similar circumstances where he was tortured. And what we found about the United States, obviously, in that case, they furnished the questions, actually, to the Syrian government, and I presume in this case as well, the U.S. furnished the questions, if not had agents in the other room while he's being tortured, and then, you know, furnishes questions, et cetera, and sees what's going on. Nothing would surprise me here.
No, absolutely. We've seen in several instances the U.S. either directly providing questions, sometimes directly involved in interrogations in third countries, or, as you said, standing behind the two-way glass and watching these interrogations. So this is not something that's completely divorced, as if they said, oh, you know, they asked for this man back because he was charged with something, so we just transferred him. There's active involvement in the detention interrogation, and so the idea that, you know, torture is happening, but they had no idea or that's not what they intended, it just doesn't pass the laugh test.
What's the best that we can hope for and work for in this case?
Well, I mean, I think in this case, what we really need to see is Congress to step in and definitively say that, in fact, you cannot transfer somebody just because they're outside of U.S. custody, outside of U.S. borders into the custody of people who torture, and that, in fact, diplomatic assurances aren't acceptable from countries who have records of torture.
What are the chances of that?
You know, we're always hopeful. We're asking this Congress just as we asked the last Congress, and there's some people very interested, you know, both in the House and the Senate, in pushing this issue forward. But if we're going to leave it to the interpretations of the U.S. administration, I don't think we're getting very far at all.
One other aspect of this case that's interesting to me, I mean, there's actually two. There's, as you can maybe bring us up to date on, there's an investigation in Germany going on because of a similar rendition, of course, but not to another country, but to the U.S. custody of a German citizen. And then what I understand from lawyers I work with in Europe is that the CIA agents, after they would do these kidnappings, whether the one of the German citizen or of the Egyptian, they would go to a hotel in Mallorca off the coast of Spain, and they would register under their own names, order their pornographic movies and all that kind of stuff. And now there's apparently an investigation in Spain going on about the possibility of indicting them for essentially using Spain as a staging ground. Are you familiar with that at all?
Absolutely. I think, and they've even been able to track some of these rendition flights by tracking the numbers of the private jets. And so it is seen that directly connected to some of these renditions that either before or after these pilots were stopping in Mallorca, like you said, enjoying themselves in their own names, their own credit cards at some, what I understand to be very fancy hotels.
Well, I do want to say not their own credit cards, because they were enjoying at these luxury resorts at exorbitant fees at the taxpayer dollar. So we paid for that.
Okay, yeah, and when I'm saying their own credit cards, clearly taxpayer expense, but the fact is they weren't hiding their identities when they were checking into these places. When it comes to cases, there is certainly an investigation going on as well into the Al-Masri case in Germany, and I think what's significant there is many times when people think of renditions, they think it's the U.S. sending somebody to a third country that tortures. But it's the way we define rendition, it's any extrajudicial or extralegal transfer of a person from the custody of one state into another where they face torture or other human rights abuses. And so in this sense, we see the genesis of the problem with these informal transfers where people don't have an opportunity to be heard in terms of whether or not they should be detained, whether or not they have a credible fear of torture or persecution. And that's where the problem starts. So we do hear, and again, rumors, but we do hear that there may be indictments of CIA officials in Germany as well.
We're talking with Jemana Moussa, Director of Advocacy for Domestic Human Rights and International Justice at Amnesty International. So what can people do if they're concerned about what they're hearing?
You can go on our website. We always have information, actions you can take. We encourage you to get educated, to pass that information along to others, and to also let your elected officials know that you can't accept this practice.
Jemana Moussa of Amnesty International, thanks so much for joining us on Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Jemana.
Thank you.
In what has widely been acknowledged to have been a sham trial in Iraq, Judge Awad Hamed al-Bandar, former head of Iraq's Revolutionary Court, was sentenced to death along with Saddam Hussein. He was found guilty of being involved in the killing of 148 Shiite Muslims after a 1982 assassination attempt on the former leader. Al-Bandar was originally scheduled for execution with Saddam on December 30th. His execution was postponed, however, until after the Muslim holiday. Lawyers from the Partnership for Civil Justice in D.C., working with former Attorney General and attorney for Saddam Hussein and Al-Bandar, had been working feverishly since late December to halt this execution. We are delighted to welcome Mara Verheiden-Hilliard from the Partnership to Law and Disorder. Mara, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Hi, Heidi.
Tell us how you got involved in this case, and can you bring us up to date with the current status?
Yes, we're representing Judge Bandar, who was arrested or surrendered to the U.S. military personnel in early 2004, and who has been sentenced to death in Iraq by the Iraqi Special Tribunal. And we are working on this case with former U.S. Attorney General Ramsey Clark, who is the lead attorney and attorney for Judge Bandar in this matter.
Where is Judge Bandar right now?
He's being held in U.S. custody by the United States government at Camp Cropper, which is in the Green Zone in Iraq.
Mara, tell us why you got involved and why you're trying to stop the hangings.
Well, what's happened in this case is, in the last most recent period, is that on December 26th, the appellate court in Iraq upheld the order for executions of Judge Bandar as well as Saddam Hussein. And we immediately went to court in the District of Columbia and Federal District Court that evening, filing emergency motions on the 26th for a temporary restraining order pending a habeas petition that we also filed. We had a TRO hearing the next day, an emergency hearing, which the court denied a request for a temporary restraining order as well as for the petition, although there was not a full hearing on the matter. And then we took an immediate appeal to the D.C. Circuit within 2 days of that. The D.C. Circuit thereafter denied that appeal. We, after a panel made a determination on the filings, we then sought an en banc rehearing. That was denied. We also went to the Supreme Court to get an emergency stay. What we're seeking to do is to stop the United States government from transferring Judge Bandar out of their custody to certain death. We believe that this is a violation of international law, and we believe that the United States government, which is under the jurisdiction of the United States courts, should be bound.
By international law?
By the U.S. law. There are issues of international law, there are issues of the Geneva Convention, there are a wide range of very significant matters that need to be addressed in a full hearing related to the underlying trial, which was a show trial, which has been widely condemned internationally by even Human Rights Watch, by international lawyers and observers, by the UN, by human rights activists around the world. But at this moment, the focus that we have in the court is to say to the court that the U.S. government and its military, under the jurisdiction of the court has the right and the ability, and we believe the duty, to issue a temporary restraining order and a stay to keep Judge Bandar from being handed over to his death.
If you are successful in getting the temporary restraining order, then what happens?
Well, then we would want to have a full hearing on the underlying habeas petition. The habeas petition addresses the fact that there has clearly been no competent tribunal or trial which has resulted in a death sentence in this case. Instead, you have a tribunal that is an illegally conceived and constructed entity, constructed really by the United States government under its occupation of Iraq, which in itself is a violation, as an occupying entity does not have the right to change and alter the court system of the country or of the place that it occupies.
And how long did the trial take, the kangaroo court, if you will?
Well, from the time that the trial began, it was approximately seven months before the defense was able to begin its case.
Now, who are the defense attorneys?
The defense attorneys include Ramsey Clark.
Oh, he did represent him.
As well as a team of very excellent, committed attorneys from Iraq and from the region, from the Arab states. Three of the defense attorneys were murdered during the course of the trial. Were not provided adequate security, and most of them received...
Three of the defense attorneys were murdered.
Three of the defense attorneys in this case were murdered during the trial under really horrific murders, one involving extraordinary torture, I believe limbs chopped off, drilling. And, you know, no action was taken in response to this. Throughout the trial, Judge Bandar, who in essence is being tried, to the extent you can call it a trial, in essence was put on trial for himself presiding over a trial two decades earlier in the 80s. This related to the Dujail assassination attempt on President Hussein in 1982, after which 148 people from the town of Dujail who were found to participate in the assassination attempt ended up themselves being executed. They were executed 3 years after the event. There was a two-year-long trial. After that, there was another year of review by a panel review. Judge Bandar was the trial judge in that case in significantly long proceedings. These were not as often described by the press as if people were just killed on
right.
the spot. There was a process in proceedings. This was during the Iran-Iraq War, and the uprising, the attempt to assassinate Saddam Hussein into jail was believed to have been coordinated with Iran at that time. But this is a situation where the judge in this case, Judge Bandar, was being tried for being the presiding judge in the Dujail trial. However, throughout this trial before the Iraqi Special Tribunal, he was never allowed to present or allowed to even access the records of that very trial. How can you put someone on trial for being a judge in a trial and not allow them even access to or allowed to present the records? He kept saying, if I can show you the records from the trial, I can show you my innocence.
Right. So this was a total violation of due process.
And there's an acknowledgement that the U.S. government possesses those records.
Isn't it true, Mara, under Iraqi law, that if you don't execute 30 days after a court decision, you no longer can carry out the execution?
From the laws, I think there's some lack of clarity from the law as it has been previously publicly announced that there was, from December 26, that the execution needed to be carried out within 30 days. There were some other interpretations that some were suggesting that it had to be carried out after 30 days. I think there was a lack of clarity. Our understanding was that it was to be carried out within 30 days. But you could see that the government, the puppet government of Iraq, Maliki and others, were very eager to try and kill these men as quickly as possible. And it should also be noted that the government of Iraq, which is and Maliki, which is comes from the Dawa party, is the party as well that was involved in the Dujail killings and the Dujail attempt assassination against President Hussein.
What, if anything, can our listeners do in this regard?
I think it's critical that people look at this and understand it from the political underlying perspective. It's important that people understand what is really happening here. The U.S. government went into a sovereign country, bombed it, attacked it, took it over, strung up its president, is seeking to kill others. Bush has just announced that he's going to send more than 20,000 more troops into Iraq to deepen the occupation in Iraq. The people of the United States have made it clear that they want this war to end. The Iraqis want the U.S. soldiers to leave Iraq. And people in the United States must speak out. They can't be cowed by the government's demonization, as the government has sought to demonize the former government of Iraq in order to justify initially its intervention, its aggressive attack on that sovereign country, as it's continued to try and justify its ongoing occupation, as it's continued to try and justify this trial, in the hope that people in the United States, and particularly that the peace movement, would be silent about these executions. And as people may have seen, there was a full-page ad in the New York Times
last week.
Well, for the Bush administration, for George Bush and his other high officials, it's clear that the acts that they've carried out in waging this war of aggression against the Iraqi people, as well as their own internal domestic attacks on civil rights and civil liberties in the United States, are violations of the Constitution, are violations of their obligations under the law.
Clearly impeachable offenses, in other words.
Are impeachable offenses. People may have seen there was a full-page ad in the New York Times last Friday demanding the impeachment of George Bush. It was sponsored by ImpeachBush.org with articles of impeachment that were drafted by former Attorney General Ramsey Clark. This has been widely supported by people around the country. There have been more than 800,000 signers on the referendum to impeach Bush. There's a huge outpouring in response to that. And the impeachment movement is joining together with the anti-war movement for a massive march on Washington on March 17th, the fourth anniversary of the war against the people of Iraq. And it's a march to the Pentagon. It's also the 40th anniversary of the 1967 historic march on the Pentagon. So
everyone should go to Washington then. Is there a website that has information about that?
ImpeachBush.org,
okay.
Which is supporting the action. We'll have increasing information up on it. The Answer Coalition, which is answercoalition.org, is the initiator of the march. And this march is being endorsed and supported by a huge range of people across the country and different organizations and prominent people like Alice Walker, the writer, Howard Zinn, the author of People's History of the United States, Paul Haggis, the director of CRASH, Father Roy Bourgeois from the School of America's Watch, Malik Rahim from Common Ground Collective in New Orleans. Really, everyone is stepping forward and saying, we must end this now, and we must end this by our collective action. So people will be coming together March 17th, March on the Pentagon. I encourage everyone to get involved. And the impeachment movement is going to be there in huge numbers.
Definitely a worthy effort and one that we support here on Law and Disorder. Mara, when do you expect to hear from the courts in this case?
Well, the courts in the United States have denied our petitions for relief and have denied our petitions for a stay. However, there is the appellate court is still considering the underlying appeal to it. It refused to stay in terms of ordering the United States that it cannot transfer custody, which we believe is violative of the law, because if the United States transfers custody, it deprives the court of jurisdiction. And obviously, if this man is executed, it deprives the court of its ability to hear his claim and his ability to seek redress in the court. But we are still waiting for a ruling on the underlying issues in the court. But for the emergency motions, those have been denied.
Mara, this is such a critical case. We greatly appreciate your sharing what's been happening over the past few weeks with us and wish you the best of luck in the decision.
Thank you, Heidi.
Thanks, Mara. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Visit us on the web at lawanddisorder.org. You can tell us what you think or listen to a past show.
We'd like to thank our affiliates and our many listeners.
The ideas expressed here on Law and Disorder are our own and not those of the organizations for which we work.